Hello, and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Eli, back with you, kicking off season 8, believe it or not, of the AAMFT podcast. And I told you that I would have something big in store for season 8. So what we've done is we've collected all of our favorite guests over the last 7 years, say, based on downloads, based on listener feedback. And we got them together and said, who would you like to talk to in a therapeutic conversation? Friends, colleagues, talking about the heart of systemic therapy. So what you will see in our 8th season in 2026 is a collection of conversation with the most influential voices in systemic therapy. Each episode is going to bring together panel of pioneers who've helped define how we understand change, relational dynamics, and the craft of helping couples and families heal. Who's who of the podcast. And I have been so excited conducting this project, and every interview and every panel seems to have something unforeseen and just amazing. It could only happen when you bring true MFTs and relational healers together. Also, some of you are listening to me like old school, and some of you will see this to kick off this historic all-star panel series podcast in 2026, coming to you in video and audio. Today's first all-star panel is going to bring together three of the most respected and enduring names in our field: Norm Epstein, Frank DiTillio, and I call her the First Lady of Family Therapy, Chloe Madonnas. They each represent a powerful strand in the evolution of modern couple and family therapy. Norm Epstein, Professor Emeritus at the University of Maryland and co-developer with Don Baucom of Cognitive Behavioral Couple Therapy. His decades of research and clinical work have profoundly influenced how we integrate cognitive, emotional, and communication-focused interventions to strengthen relationships. Through his teaching, writing, and mentorship, Norm has trained generations of therapists in the science of relational thinking and change. Frank DiTillio is a clinical psychologist, a family therapist, and one of the world's foremost authorities on cognitive behavioral therapy with families. Emanating from Allentown, Pennsylvania, Frank serves as a clinical associate professor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He's authored over 300 scholarly works. His teaching and writing have helped bridge the gap between the individual world of CBT and the systemic world of MFT. Chloe Madonnas is a pioneer of strategic family therapy, known for her creative and sometimes provocative interventions that transform how therapists approach power, hierarchy, and love within families. A longtime collaborator of Jay Haley and co-founder of the Family Therapy Institute of Washington, D.C., Chloe's influence spans decades of teaching, writing, and training. Her books, including Strategic Family Therapy and more recent efforts, The Secret Meaning of Money, with a legend in his own right, motivational speaker Tony Robbins, reflect her enduring curiosity about how people change and how meaning is constructed in relationships. Together, Norm, Frank, and Chloe represent three distinct but deeply complementary approaches to systemic therapy, each rooted in respect for science, creativity, and the complexity of the human condition. Sit back, let's dive in to this rich conversation, the debut of the All-Star Panel edition of the AAMFT podcast. All right. Welcome to the AAMFT podcast. We are so lucky to be joined today in our continuing roundtable series. I call it the All-Stars Panel, the Legends Roundtable, where we are talking about the heart and soul of change and systemic therapy from really important model developers, luminaries in the field, and our important former guest that I've had a lot of fun talking to. And today I am joined by Chloe Madonis, consider her the first lady of family therapy, Frank DiTilio, and Norm Epstein. And I can't wait to talk to you guys today. And the first question we're asking everybody is a two-parter. If you had to explain to someone that knows nothing about therapy, how does change occur in systemic therapy? And then who is responsible for that change? So whoever wants to start us off, go ahead.
It's very difficult to generalize. There are many ways that change can happen. You can change by reading a book, by listening to a lecture, by taking a trip, by seeing a family member in a new light, or you can change in therapy. But I believe that change can happen in a second, in a minute. It is that moment when the person realizes it doesn't have to be like this. I can change and I can help others to change. And so, of course, it's easier for change to happen when you're working with a family rather than an individual. Because when you work with an individual, you just have one point of view. You don't know if the person is saying the truth. You really have no reality check. When you're working with a family, you have a reality check, and then you really get to know people. It's very different if you meet a father, you know he's a father, and you'll imagine he may be a good father, but when you get the son's opinion about this, it's a total revelation. It's a different point of view. And so I think that change can happen more quickly and more effectively in the social context of the person, be it the family or the workplace or the study place. It's very important to consider the social context.
I really always focus on the time where the moment when people realize that change is possible, because so many clients come to us and they are feeling stuck in many ways, individually in their lives or in their family, families, and so forth. And the change is where they see the opportunity that it doesn't have to be that way, that there are options. And the process of that, it often, there's the interpersonal context of the therapeutic relationship, the sort of common factors aspect of how what the therapist brings to the interaction that helps the person see that there are other possibilities, encouraging it or helping the person actually conceive of differences. Part of it is behavioral change, seeing that there can actually be a change and a pattern doesn't have to be the same, or actually conceptualizing that change can be different, seeing a goal that you can work toward that would be different, that you'd love to work toward, and then thinking about the possibilities of getting and going in that direction. And as she was saying, that when you see the family together, there are more opportunities for us that having an impact on that where people are stuck.
Yeah, I think those are excellent points. And I also think sometimes change is very subtle and you have to pay attention because it happens right under your nose and you miss it. That there is a very subtle indicators that they're beginning to make change, especially if they were resistant about coming in and now that resistance has lessened, they're interacting a little bit more. I also think that people have this notion that change is going to be real obvious and upfront, and they're waiting for it. When in fact, I often tell them change is part of the process of evolving, and it's not always, sometimes it can be elusive, and we have to take a look back, which is why I keep very careful notes and also observations. So I think it's interesting. It's something that can sometimes be very elusive. And then people realize, oh my God, I'm being more assertive than I used to be. I'm not afraid of a lot of things that I was afraid of before. Or family members are interacting in a way that's completely different.
Yeah.
I had a family that they were so torn that they were coming to the family therapy session separately. And then one time they said, we came together this time because of gas and all that gas cost and all that. Well, it had nothing to do with the cost of gas, but had to do with the fact that they're starting to move closer together with each other. So those are sometimes, I think, interesting things that you point out as the observer as to what's transpiring with them.
And then who is responsible for change? Is it the therapist? Is it the client system? Is it the relationship between the therapist and the client system? How would you answer that for someone that asked you, who is responsible for change?
Let me go back a little bit to the previous question. I think that change happens all the time. We are constantly changing. We cannot stop changing. Our circumstances change. We grow old. We grow healthier or sicker. Our children grow up. Change happens all the time. The task of the family therapist is to direct that change in a positive way, because people can change in a negative way or in a positive way. But they're changing. Everything changes all the time.
Yeah, I would agree. It's a collaborative process, and the therapist certainly isn't solely responsible for it, but can facilitate that it goes in a good direction, as you say.
Yeah,
and I think we facilitate change, but it's very important that they take that responsibility for change, or otherwise we're fostering an unnecessary dependence, which we don't want to do. We're always working our way out of the job, and if we're successful, we'll be unemployed at the end of the process because we did what we were intended to do, is to build that independence for them to do that on their own. I tell them I take responsibility for guiding you and facilitating it, but you pick up the ball and you run with it. And if you don't, then that's up to you.
In a couple of family therapy, we're faced sometimes really often with the idea that along with that, the members of our family may come in with different agendas, that they see somebody else in the family as responsible. They're standing on ceremony like, oh, I've done my part. Now something else needs to do something. And how do we help them sort of get engaged that everybody can play a role and everybody can make some positive contributions to change?
Yeah, that's a beautiful segue, Norm, to the next question. If you had to describe to someone that knows nothing about systemic thinking or couple and family therapy, what do you think the major differences are that separate individual therapy from a systemic relational couple and family therapy?
Okay, it is so rare for me to do individual therapy because even, let's say, individual therapy, sometimes the student-teacher relationship becomes very similar to therapy. So sometimes I have a student, I'm talking to the student, it's an individual. In the conversation, they might bring up, I have this problem, I have this limitation, I find it so hard to do this, or can I ask you something about my family? And I'm always thinking about the important people in that student's life. So even if I don't have those people present in the room or in the conversation, they are present in my way of thinking. And so when I give, most of my work is giving directives. So when I give a directive, it's usually interpersonal. It's almost always interpersonal. It's not about thinking about something, meditating or something or anything like that. It's always, have you tried to tell your husband this or that? Have you asked your child this question and that question? So I'm always thinking interactionally. It has become such a reflex that I really find it very hard to think differently. And I don't want to think differently. There's no
point. What do you think systemically you can think no other way? Yes, and you can be a relational therapist with one person in the room when you're considering them in all their interpersonal context, like you said, Chloe. What do you guys, gentlemen, think about the major differences between a linear individual type of thinking and a more mutual causality, circular way of relationally, systemically working with the couples and families?
I think that when you have a one-to-one relationship in an individual therapy session, there's always room for more direct contact as opposed to when there's a group. I remember one time many years ago, Sal Mnuchin said that when he has a family or more than one, he sees himself as a reflective instrument of change, which is interesting because when you have that more than one dynamic, that becomes more apropos as opposed to when you have more of a one-to-one kind of a situation. I also think that no matter what type of therapy you use, it tends to be a little bit more dyadic when it's one-to-one as opposed to family, because then you're harnessing that energy that's going on between the familial interaction. And so you have to take a different stance for that. I don't know if you agree with that, Norm, or Mark.
Yeah, and I also think systemically all the time, systemically, but also there are things going on inside individuals that may need some a little bit more linear attack sometimes. Because, so for example, one person in a family is showing some change, and I, in a person's life, I'm seeing them individually or in the family session, and another person actually doesn't believe it. In other words, like, I've known this person for a long time. They're just trying to impress you, the therapist. They're the same. And the person, there's some things going on in that person that are making it difficult for them to be open to the possibility that this other person actually is changing. Maybe it's scary to them, the person changes, whatever. So sometimes my exploring that individual's inner thoughts, their fears, whatever, it becomes there. So it's focused on the individual, because what goes on inside of them is going to have an impact on how they interact with the other people, who then, of course, will interact differently with them. So it's, I'm always thinking of the context, the interpersonal part, but at times I can't help noticing the way the person is responding emotionally or cognitively is a relevant thing to focus on as well.
In couple and family therapy, we study cycles or patterns of interactions, feedback loops. And in order to intervene in the cycle, first you have to understand the cycle. And therapists, depending on their orientation or particular style, have in different ways of intervening to break up a dysfunctional cycle, whether it be for an individual, a couple, or a family. Please tell us about your favorite way to break up a cycle.
Sometimes I'll join the cycle temporarily almost as a family member when I'm working with them, because you can't do it from a distance. You have to be more enmeshed in with. So that's a little bit tricky, but lots of the former systemic therapists often talked about joining the family system temporarily. And I sometimes find it that some of the old films that we used to see where they were like, they'd order dinner and they were eating dinner together while they were having the family therapy session, and little subtle things like the therapist that would ask for a Coke and then the kid would ask for a Sprite, and then he'd change and say, you know what, that make mine a Sprite too. I think I'll go with a Sprite. Just a bonding thing that we're getting into the thick of this. I find this specifically true when you deal with families in crisis, because you can't remain too much afar. You have to get into the thick with it. Whitaker would sometimes cry with family members when there was some kind of a tragedy or crisis. And you could see that on film. That was very powerful. Virginia Satir did the same thing. I use that oftentimes because I can find that I can work with them a little bit better. And then you, of course, back yourself out as the therapy progresses.
So mostly teaching. And sometimes a student will say to me, I'm going to cry in this session. I won't be able to contain myself. This is just too sad. So what happens if I can't help it and I cry? And I say, I don't care. You can cry. Just do the job. Do your work. It doesn't matter. Experience whatever emotions you want as long as you do the work.
I also would let the pattern play out in the session too, and let it intensify, and at some point interrupt it. And I might share a little bit about my feelings. I feel so this is getting so intense, and it feels like it's going around in a circle. How do all of you feel about that? And allow people to express their sadness at it being that way, or their frustration, and talking about possibility. It would sure be nice if there's some way to interact differently about this. And I wonder if we could explore that, or some other ways, things that in there are all these points at which somebody does something and people have options of responding this way or that way. And just thinking about some other ways this could be approached that would feel so bad.
My favorite peeves, the things that worry me tremendously about the world of therapy and family therapy specifically, there's a phenomenon going on in the country, and it's expanding to many places in the world, of parental estrangement, adult children that disconnect completely from the parents. The parents typically don't know why. They don't understand what they did wrong. What is the reason? The parents have no idea where these adult children are living, what they're doing. The grandchildren don't know the grandparents. There are many groups on the internet today, Parents Grieving for Living Children is the name of one of those groups. Some countries have taken the initiative in solving this. I don't remember whether it's China or Singapore or Japan, one of the Asian countries, that will fine the adult children for not taking care of the parent, and will reduce the taxes of adult children who live near the elderly parent.
Interesting, Chloe. You're the second person to bring that up as a larger change that they have seen. Why do you think, what type of macro societal influences, why do you think therapists are seeing more of this estrangement between parents and children?
I think it's a change in values, a decadence of traditional values, where previous generations wouldn't even consider the possibility of estranging from their parents. One of the Ten Commandments is respect your parents. It doesn't say love your parents. It says respect them. And in respect, there's a continuity. There is a relationship. I think there might be economic factors. Some of these adult children don't want to have the responsibility of taking care of the elderly parents. As people live longer, they may be looking at maybe 20 years where the parents are elder, maybe sick, but are still alive and somebody has to take care of them. The consequences for society are very serious because the basic economic unit of capitalism is the family and the transmission of wealth within the family. In our country, in the United States, most people, in the middle class at least, own their home. And it's a tradition that the home will pass to the children. Most elderly people have property or have something that they will pass to the children. And these parents that have been estranged are changing their will, are disinheriting the children, and are leaving their money to charity. And this is a huge change in society. And I think, of course, that pop psychology plays a huge role in this. That is pretty disgusting, to say the least, because it encourages people to diagnose others, to diagnose their parents. My mother is toxic. My father is narcissistic. Mm. Throw them out. We don't want anything to do. Is your mother toxic? Oh, she said this and that to me. So I say, that was not very nice. I agree. That was not a nice thing to say. But estranging from your mother is giving her the death penalty. Because when you estrange from somebody, you're killing them. They're not alive to you anymore. They're dead. And do you think your mother deserves the death penalty because of what she said to you? So that's what I question. Narcissistic, basically every man in the world is narcissistic, according to the definition. Yeah, the guy doesn't want to do what the woman tells him to do, so he's narcissistic. And so divorce. Then the children are impoverished. Another woman leaves the man, the children are impoverished because he was the breadwinner. And what are the consequences for society? And this is all pop psychology. Really, university psychology doesn't dwell on this. Sure. But there are so many family therapists that have adopted this language, the language of toxic and narcissistic and intruding and all these words that are typically used. I can't even remember more words because I have such a phobia to these words.
Well, it seems associated with the contrast and conflict between individualistic values and collectivist values in Hong Kong. So I've done a lot of collaboration with colleagues in China, which has been very collective in society. And with the westernization in China, it has become much more and more young couples and young individuals, this focus on individual attainment and achievement and so forth. And actually, the predominant, I think Chloe was referring to, I believe that those laws were actually passed in China, that adult children could be actually punished, penalized for not taking good care of their parents. And it's interesting that it used to be that was just part of their cultural beliefs. That's what you do. And now people are all of a sudden, they have to, you have laws to have people do that. And those pop psychology books are very individualistically oriented. I'm okay, and these other people are toxic. It's just, how am I going to be okay, take care of my personal needs and not be influenced by these terrible people?
Yeah, in Japan, a lot of young people will hire proxies to go in their place to see their parents, so they're not ignoring their parents, but they yet stay away from them. That's the same thing, which is the most bizarre thing I ever heard. But it's apparently considered some line of respect, at least as interim, that they haven't completely abandoned that. Yeah, it's very interesting because they could be held accountable for abandoning their folks.
Yeah, the climate of which the three of you entered this profession and the climate of which we are in now is very different. One can argue family therapy, given what we're talking about, is needed more than ever. So let's talk about engendering hope, instilling hope. How do you connect to hope in even the most constrained systems? And how do you help clients build hope within their own lives and relationships?
That's a good question. It's not an easy one to answer. And I think sometimes we have to operationally define some of those terms when we look at hope and how that changed that versus desire and expectations. So hope, I'm assuming you're saying hope for change, or hope for an improvement in terms of interactional relationships. Maybe if we can define that a little bit better.
People enter therapy demoralized, and it's our job to help remoralize them, help them connect to things that give them changing the thinking. Because if I can't change the thinking, it's really hard to change the doing or the feeling. So hope is a powerful extra therapeutic factor, not tied to one specific approach or model, but seems like a important ingredient to most successful therapies and therapeutic relationships. And everybody has a different way of connecting to it as a therapist. And it's almost like you have to buy it to sell it, Frank. And if I can't feel hopeful sitting in a room with a couple or a family, it's a negative sign for me and my ability to be an agent of change. So I'm just asking you all how you connect to hope working with very challenging systems.
I don't use the word hope because hope implies that there's something that's not there that you have to hope for, pray, or have a good intention towards that. I just say, do it. That's why I don't use the word try to be this or that. Try, no, just do it. So I think one important way to work with individuals is bring me back to the idea of working with an individual. I think that everybody should have a mission statement. Write your mission statement. What is your mission in life? What gives meaning to your life? What is your purpose? it's so important because when you talk with people about how everybody needs a mission, a purpose, you are elevating them. You are implying that this individual's mission is important for humanity. And that's why they should not only have a mission, a purpose, but write it, put it in writing, put it up on the wall somewhere where it's going to remind you that is your mission. And that way you can overcome all the difficulties, petty or very serious in life, when you have a mission.
Right. I don't tend to necessarily use the word hope, but I do discuss with the clients and family the idea of their belief that whether some changes are possible and feasible or realistic. And I agree with you, the idea that of demonstrating some that something can happen immediately. So you say, do it, and they do it. So when they do it, they've obviously just demonstrated that they can do this when it hadn't happened before. So I'm also trying to encourage people to try out something that is different from what they've done, some do something. And the thing is that we then have to sometimes have a discussion that you've seen somebody else in your family or yourself behave in a different way, but to what extent do you believe that's going to stick, that will actually continue, and that, or that it'll slide back, or the person may say, I think I gave the example before, oh, my family member is just doing that to impress you, the therapist at home, they're not going to do it differently. So somehow addressing that skepticism. And the more that people see themselves or others doing something different, and however you motivate them to do that, the more you can start to build that, change that expectancy that this is less, but actually it can't be different.
Yeah, I think realistic expectations of what one has about change, we can talk about hope in terms of that, but I think we have to put it in perspective sometimes. Sometimes people are very unrealistic. And they say, I'll have hope that my spouse is going to change and do this and do that. They may be not capable of changing and may not be realistic. Some of the modern therapies have looked at that, teaching people how to learn to love the problem as opposed to hoping that they have an unrealistic hope that something is going to change. You can do all kinds of different things with perspectives and perceptions. And so I think it's a relative issue, but grounding them and operationally defining terms and expectations, I think, are very important, particularly in today's world, which I find absolutely crazy sometimes because it makes my head spin around. We didn't have these problems in the 70s. A guy calls me up the other day. He says, I got to come in and see you right away. I said, what's going on? He said, it's a tragedy. My wife's, my marriage is on the rocks and I'm just falling apart. So I squeezed him into the schedule and he comes in and I said, what's going on? And he said, oh, everything is falling apart. I said, what happened? He said, my wife broke up with her boyfriend. Now, I had some wax build up in this ear, so I wasn't sure, and I was hearing him clearly. I said, could you say that in this ear? Because I'm not sure I heard you correct. He said, my wife just broke up with her boyfriend. I said, your wife has a boyfriend? He said, yeah, that's how we stay together. That's how our relationship works. I said, well, my God, we should go on Match.com immediately and get her a new boyfriend. What are you telling me? And then he goes on to tell me how they live together, but it's open, so she can have a boyfriend and she has these love relationships, but she stays with me and it works. And now she broke up and now she's talking about moving away and everything's falling apart. I think this is a little bit of unrealistic expectation that somehow we're going to get some homeostasis here. So grounding him and helping him understand from anyone's perspective that, first of all, this is a little bit of a crazy situation, even though it works for you. It's volatile in terms of expectations and what you need and what happens if she doesn't find a new boyfriend and how do you go on with this? I think operationally defining those terms and clarifying what's realistic and what's not and what we can shoot for is in terms of an objective grounding them is sometimes a very important work to do, or you're not going to make any progress at all and they're going to leave and things aren't. It'll go further or forward.
It's a couple therapy that focuses on trying to balance what are realistic changes you can make and what things that you do have to step back and say, maybe I can accept that it's going to be this way and it could be okay.
Right. Yeah. You all are saying important things. So Chloe's talking about a mission statement. Frank and Norm are talking about helping people develop realistic expectations, realistic hope. How do you work with someone that is unmotivated. And many times when you have multiple people in the room in couple and family therapy, you have different motivations. So what if they don't want to write a mission statement, Chloe? Or what if they are unwilling to participate or change? How do you work with, I call them hostage clients or people, they are against their will. They're really not there because they're in the action stage of change and ready to go. They're there for other reasons.
I see that person individually to be able to join and connect with them one-on-one. And in the conversation, I make a huge effort to understand the individual person and understand that it's not that they're mean or that they're uncooperative. There's a reason. And I have to listen carefully and understand it and then offer them something that is what they want, what they need. Very often, for example, that person that doesn't want to collaborate, that doesn't want to change, is very focused on the need for feeling important, feeling significant, feeling respected. And I have to arrange for that person to get that respect, that sense of importance, individualism. Sometimes it's because they are so bitter because they've been feeling unloved for a long time and they cannot even conceive that they could possibly be loved. And so I work on that and I work on elevating the person and those fears and motivations, make them important. So your mission statement doesn't have to be something to change the world. It could be to get my wife to love me is my mission in life. All that I want is my wife to love me. And that's my mission, and I'll put it in writing. Or it could be not to have my children hate me. That's a good mission also. The mission doesn't have to be grandiose.
Yeah, I look at unmotivation sometimes is they're motivated to go in an opposite direction. And so I'll harness that strength and try to understand why are they motivated to go in an opposite direction? Because you're here, you're showing up every week. So you must be connected or looking for something or you wouldn't be showing up. If you're completely unmotivated, you wouldn't be here. So you're here. Why are you motivated in the opposite direction? Explain to me. Because I want to understand that, learn, because maybe you've got something here and I'm missing it. So I usually get in their thinking, and that's a lot of what we do as a cognitive behavioral therapist is try to understand how the individual sees the situation from their perspective. Very important. I had a couple one time where the wife was a gourmet chef and she was making her husband all these phenomenal meals and all kinds of exotic stuff. And he just wanted her to do the basic meat and potatoes. And she said, so insulting. I could whip up all of these wonderful dishes and he wants like meatloaf and mashed potatoes. Come on, how banal is that? It wasn't banal to him because when I talked to him about it in front of her, he said, this is how my mother showed us love. She gave us a lot of staples. They were Hungarian and they believed in goulashes and beefs and a lot of potatoes and stuff like that. That was staple for us. Yes, it was the same, but we were limited. But it's where the love came from, okay? This stuff is prehistoric to me. I don't even know what the hell you cooked. I don't know what I'm eating, and I don't need to have that. I just need more of a peasant's meal, as he would call it. And when she could hear that, she could understand his motivation away from getting all the exotic stuff. And I think that's what I do is when I look at them as being motivated in the opposite direction, try to understand what their motivation is about so that now we can live it and understand it. Now, whether they choose to keep that and vary it a little bit, that's maybe something he may venture out to do, saying that your wife that differs from your mom because she wants to show you introduce you to some new things that you may actually really enjoy. And bring it to the session because I'll eat it.
Chloe and Frank, you're both really focusing on the importance of connecting with the needs and the motive of the person. So the person isn't unmotivated. Their motives just aren't being addressed. And you have to figure out what they are, empathize with them, show them that, and then say, then all of a sudden when they can say that, okay, maybe my needs also could get met in this therapy. Where I've seen that happen so often, is in families where they, drag an adolescent into family therapy, and they listen to the kid. He's so slouched over in a chair, puts a hood over his head, doesn't want to interact. It's okay, this looks like a very unmotivated person. But when you really, if they get an opportunity, the therapist can give them an opportunity, talk about what they want. Is exactly what we're talking about in terms of they feel ignored, unlistened to, unloved, and so forth. Now, this in those family situations is tricky because I still have to honor the role of the parents. They're in charge in this family, but somehow uncover these needs of a kid. And when you do that, the kid all of a sudden sits up on the chair. Something's changed.
The longer I do this work, I realize that people, as you all were saying, they want to be listened to, validated, heard. And a lot of times the way therapists are trained is in a certain theory or certain techniques that go with that theory. And then when you watch that clinician work, they're just interacting in an organic flow way. So the next questions are in your own work, speaking for yourself, how important are theory in technique in what you actually do?
Not very important for me. Not very important. I am myself. I think a lot of the theory and technique is so internalized in me that I don't even make it conscious. Find out the social context. Who are the important people in the person's life? How do they fulfill their most important needs? Things like that, it's just automatic. It's an automatic process. But I listen to people like a human being. I set all that aside. I'm not thinking technique. I'm not thinking I'm going to use this strategy, that strategy. Even though my work is strategic family therapy, that's not the way I think. I'm just thinking, how can I get to really listen and understand these people and help them the way they want to be helped, not the way I think they should be helped.
Before you all weigh in, I have to comment on that, because yes, Chloe is known for a school of thinking. Strategic family therapy is very technique driven, even paradoxical by nature. And Chloe's answer was somewhat paradoxical, is that she just treats him like a human and listens and interacts, which makes me think the evolution of even model developers and pioneers is really important. And you've certainly evolved, Chloe.
But see, I beg to differ with my lovely friend and colleague who I've known for many decades. She is a mega master therapist. She doesn't even realize that she is using technique because she's been doing it so long and she's so damn good at it. But she is, because we all listen and in a humanistic way with compassion, but we're also making a roadmap of where we're going and what we're going to do with what we get. And it's interesting because the young students out there that are neophytes and they're just getting started have to understand that someday they will evolve to where the master is, and it will be like putting on a glove or doing something every day. But there is technique in there, and it's not as scripted as we're looking at a cookbook and we're saying, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that next. It comes from the gut, comes from the heart. But there is time when, depending on what you get, and Trevor, you've got to use technique and you've got to stand back a little bit on theory so that you can conceptualize it and then take a look at where you're going. Because depending on the volatility you get with some of these families, particularly in crisis or couples, it could go astray real quick. So I think, because, and I don't want to speak for Norm, but we're of the same ilk. We use a cognitive behavioral approach against a systems backdrop. But because we usually focus on specifics, we do rely a little bit more on technique and theory, probably more like Chloe, that we blended in a very smooth kind of way. But I think we still utilize that because that's the nature of what we do.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that CBT has been stereotyped part of it. I think it's still working out there, the stereotypes that it's completely technique driven. And if you look back at the history of it, some of the old days back in the 60s and 70s, it was that since there were some research findings that couples who exchanged positive things more, were happier together than they were. One of the techniques was get them to set up a contract during the next week. You'll do this and you'll do that. Or communication skills, expressor skills, listener skills. Okay. And the thing is that there's still this stereotype. That's all that CBT people do. But I think if you watch Frank in a session or me a session, it might not look very different from watching Chloe in a session, that we're talking, listening to the person, getting a sense of their experience. But the theory part is still there. And there's still, I may not be saying, okay, so let's see, this person seems to have some unrealistic expectations of family life. Now, so I guess, how could I chip away at this and get the person to maybe step back and think that there's another way of looking at this? I could use some specific techniques out of a textbook, or I'll just do whatever comes into my head that seems to work with this person to make them stop and think. So there's a good amount of technique, but it's very much based on, it's organic and it's in the moment and listening to and relating to this particular client.
You know, one of the things, the pieces of feedback I got from the podcast, Norm, that I did with you and your collaborator, Don Balcom, early on, was that this, stereotype that CBT is so manualized treatment and there is very little room for kind of customizing it or putting it in your own style and language. And that's very much, as we were saying in the episode, it doesn't look like that when you and Don work, or most people can take even a manualized approach and make it flow and fit their styles. Once you know the notes, then you can improvise and play with feeling, and theory and technique give you those notes. But when you play with feeling and you improvise, then you take that and you make that part of your own style, so it looks natural and flowing and organic. But I'm curious what you all think about that. And then again, your biggest, do you think, evolution in your thinking? Because when you do a lot of work, there are some things that if I looked at a Frank DiTillio session 30, 40 years ago and looked at it now, it would look very similar. And then there's some other things that probably have evolved as our times have evolved. So it's a question, it's a hard question, but it's a question for all of you. What's been the biggest evolution in your thinking about how therapy works and how your style has evolved over the years?
Let me just say a couple of things quickly before we get into that. A number of years ago, I did a presentation for Harry Aponte's group down in Drexel. And I did the live presentation, and he said, you used a lot of nice structural techniques there. I said, of course. Why did you think that? I thought it would be a lot more kind of rigid and so on and so forth. And a number of years ago, when Norm and I were doing a workshop at WMFT, we had a nice crowd and then we were teaching them, and they said, this is really great stuff. And so we started to poll them and ask them, because they were a middle-aged group, and said, did you learn this in family therapy theories and stuff? Oh no, they skipped over it. And one woman, Laura, I think Norm fainted. I had to use smelling salts when she said this, because she said, when we got to that chapter on cognitive behavior therapy, our professor said, you might as well just rip it out of the textbook because that's not family therapy. And it went, oh my God. Later, I saw the lady down in the Starbucks coffee shop in the center where we were. And she said, I really enjoyed your presentation. And she said, I found myself really getting angry at that professor who did that, because he cheated us to learn a lot about these things. But their view was just so rigid that it was so academic and cookie cutter that they didn't consider it actually a family therapy or a marriage and family therapy approach. So I think it's evolved a lot because we, Don Balcom, Nora, myself, and a few other people really expanded it to embrace a systems approach and utilize that and blend it with a lot of structural theories and so on and so forth. And I tried to exonerate that in a 1998 casebook that I wrote, where I invited all these folks from all these different approaches, and I let them do their thing in a case. And then I went through and annotated where they could possibly integrate some things from CBT and not. And then I gave him the last word, and it was a nice kind of a dialogue between all of us. I think Susan Johnson did a chapter, Sal Mnuchin did a chapter. I think Chloe's group did, and a number of other, Carl Tom, a lot of folks, Insu Kimberg. It was really a nice dialogue. So I think we've evolved it looking at more integration than anything else over time. I don't know how the other two would say it.
I think that is totally true. From my perspective, strategic family therapy is not an orthodoxy. We take whatever works or whatever is interesting, even if we're not sure that it works, and use it. So this is not a school of therapy where you follow certain rules and you always do the same kind of thing at all. And I'm usually doing something crazy and teaching something crazy to my students. But I am so disillusioned with the way family therapy and therapy in general is going, because it is adhering more and more to rigid rules, to concepts that do not encourage progress or innovation. It's become such a rigid hierarchy. So I have to tell you, these days I mostly teach, and what I teach is life coaching. So I have currently, at any point in time now, more than 11,000 students taking our trainings. We have 7 different courses and are involving more other courses. And we certify life coaches from all parts of the world. It's completely international, different languages. And they do family therapy, they do couples therapy, they also work with individuals. They come from different backgrounds totally. We have many therapists. We have many family therapists. We also have physicians, lawyers, business people. We have mothers who just want to be a better mother, fathers who want to be a better father, owners of businesses who feel that they could improve their leadership in their company and be better with their employee relationships. And we teach all of this. A big area that we're teaching now is executive coaching, because executives and companies have typically so much power to help the employees in a positive direction. And they are themselves coaches of the people who work under them. And so it's so important. I've become, now in my old age, I've become interested in helping larger numbers of people. And I feel that family therapy has become imprisoned by pop psychology and by a dehumanizing idea of what's the right way to live or how people should change or why they couldn't change. And I think we're all human beings, and there is such a huge need everywhere in the world that the more people we can train on how to help others and how to guide people to have a better life and to be kinder towards others, we've got to do it. We cannot stay restrained to the people that come to our office. So that's what I'm focusing in. Already we've trained 17,000 life coaches, and we have ongoing 11,000. And I teach them, I give a class every week where they can ask me all kinds of questions. And it's very interesting, the different ethnic backgrounds, the different nationalities, the different issues that they can come up with. I stay alive in the profession because I have this. For example, I had a physician from the Ukraine living in Poland right now, was able to escape and is in Poland. But he coaches people that are still trapped in Ukraine, people that have had their family murdered, their little children raped and murdered, and who cannot imagine leading a positive life because they are so traumatized. So I talked with him for 20 minutes with his doctor and gave him some ideas. He was talking about one particular patient who had escaped, but her family was murdered and a little 8-year-old girl in the family was raped and murdered in front of the parents. And so this aunt, little girl, who is also in the medical profession, cannot work now, cannot do anything. She's living in that trauma. So I talked about not having the idea that she could overcome the trauma. It's better to think that some things you don't overcome, it's always going to be in her mind. That overcoming the idea that she should somehow work on being happy, no, that's too much. She could have some joyous moments. And as a doctor, she knows the importance of being able to laugh at a joke, a joyous moment that helps endorphins come out and is good for your health, but not the idea of happiness like a major thing. That's not going to happen, certainly not in the near future. And having a mission, what is she going to do for other people in Ukraine? And so he got it, very intelligent man, of course, quickly got it and said, this applies to so many other people in Ukraine that I'm trying to help. So I think it's important for all of us with all these tragedies going on in the world to give our 5 cents worth of what we can do to help. And
Chloe, would you say the way you used to help families in the golden age of family therapy, the passion you felt about that, you've taken that same spirit into coaching and teaching and reaching a larger audience? Would you say the core of who you were then is now just integrated into this larger audience? Or is there something fundamentally different about the audience is different now in teaching and coaching? But are you the same, or do you do something different in your work now in the coaching and teaching?
It's the same. So my memoir just recently came out. It's called Not by Accident. And I tell there in Argentina, I was accused in the hospital that I was working in for free, of working for the CIA, because I would like to work with the poor. And I would go to the shanty towns and talk to really poor families and work with those families totally for free and actually in dangerous situations. And so they thought, my colleagues at the hospital thought that I was gathering data for the CIA of what were the pockets of unrest in the country that were the poverty pockets. He had to stand up in a meeting of all the staff and say, no, I don't work for the CIA. But also, this is way back with Mnuchin. Frank, you were talking about Mnuchin. We had this program for training people from the community, mostly Black people and Puerto Ricans, in family therapy, people with no education. Almost all of them had not had high school. And we demonstrated that they were as good or better than the PhDs. And this was in the early 70s. So I'm still doing the same, expanding to larger group. That's all. I'm more confident. So I'm not afraid of talking to somebody who has no education or somebody who is very powerful and teaching them how to do life coaching and help other people. Sometimes there are issues that are so interesting and so shocking. I've been working with some high-level military people. I rarely do therapy myself anymore, but these are very high-level U.S. military people. And they have such a military way of thinking that every time I finish now, the therapy is over, but every time I talk to them, they would ask me, what do you think we should do? Tell us what to do. Like, how do you think we should have sex? Do you think we should have a threesome just to spice up our sex? No. So willing to take a directive.
Yeah. It's interesting because you all have a wealth of experience, and sometimes we learn the most from what didn't work, our therapeutic failures, and it's not just young professionally young therapists in training that have miscues or mistakes. So I'm curious if you could tell a story, talk about a therapeutic failure that ultimately you learned from and really changed the way that you worked and helped you be a better therapist.
Okay, I can certainly think of one right away that really tuned me into the importance of being very sensitive to my clients' values and when mine are different from theirs of how to deal with that. There's a couple came to see me some years ago and they had a couple of young children. He was a successful business owner. She worked, I believe, as a teacher, but she had retired from that at least temporarily to raise their kids. And they came in because she had been depressed and then just saying she was so unhappy. So they come to couple therapy, and as I'm listening to them, the more I hear there's a real power differential, and he's like in charge of that relationship, and I'm starting to think she's partly depressed because she's in a one-down position, her preferences don't get listened to. He actually said we're talking fairly derogatory ways about her in front of me, and they didn't even know me, and so I started to roll against my personal values out. Couple relationships and about gender and so forth. So I started to challenge that a little bit and to push back at him a little bit about the way he communicated with her. And one of the other things that I did mention at this point, his hobby was sailing, so he had a nice sailboat. Okay. So at one point he stopped and he says, "So listen, Doc, I got to tell you something. Our relationship is like a sail, like a boat. And I'm the captain and she's the crew." At which point, I don't know, I always try to keep a straight face when I'm listening to song. I don't know what my face looked like then, but that really got me uncomfortable. And so I pushed a little more. They didn't come back after that. That was the last session. And it was clear to me that I was missing something. I was empathizing with her, thinking about my position. And I didn't connect sufficiently with him. And that's where I apparently, missed the boat.
Yeah.
I have one, I guess and it had to do with cultural sensitivity. I like to think that I was very culturally sensitive because having traveled to 100 countries and worked with people all over the world, I speak different languages, but I still missed the boat. Excuse me. I was not the same boat that he missed, but I missed the boat. I was in a former Soviet bloc country years ago, and I was working with a family, and I was doing the demonstration for the people that I was training. And this family agreed to come in. And in this particular family, the father was the head of household. And although he pronounced himself as the head, but his wife pronounced herself as the heart, which was very telling, I thought. Although the Greeks are also famous, although they'll tell you the husband's the head of the family, but the mother's the neck and the neck controls the head. So watch out for her. But in this particular case, I had talked to the father about doing a homework assignment that I asked him to consider because I wanted to see if we could try some things because he was very rigid and he was very unyielding in a lot of ways. He was so offended that the next time he brought the family, but he wouldn't come in. And so I was really dumbfounded. What was it that offended him? And then my colleagues expressed that they had been under Soviet rule for so long that they were very sensitive about being told what to do. They didn't want the orders given. And I thought that I had done it in a way that was very suggestive and said, we tried an experiment. But he perceived it as being told what to do, and he just cut me right off. And I chided myself because I didn't boot up enough to understand the culture and what these people had been through. We just think communist rule's over now, it's done with. These people spent decades with that kind of lifestyle. It's when I worked with people of the Holocaust in the early 70s, when I got started in the field, and I didn't realize that they were still paranoid about the police and what people would do. I looked at it as paranoia. I didn't realize for them it was reality because it was the police oftentimes that rounded people up because they trusted them, and then they were shipped off to concentration camps. I learned a very hard lesson, and that is do your freaking homework and know your cookie before you get involved with them, particularly of their different culture, because it's very easy to offend them and step on their toes. And lots of them are very dignified and they won't come out and say it, but they'll say it passive aggressively by not coming back or not joining. And I ended up apologizing to this father for being insensitive. And he was a hard sell. He didn't like it, but he did come back. And so I had him talk a little bit about what he had been through, and that seemed to help us bond, and I did it in front of the rest of the family. It was very telling for me. So I think we have to remain sensitive, particularly in this day and age, about what people are going through. I learned this just recently when I helped in the Ukraine. I did a training program where the psychiatrists and psychologists, both Polish and Ukrainian, who were getting burned out with all of the refugees, and they were starting to have anxiety in themselves. And I talked a little bit about how to take care of themselves. And I realized that these cultures are much, much different than what we're used to, and we can't superimpose. You have to be culture blind. You can't be culture blind. You've got to have culture vision, like color vision, to be able to see what's going on and understand where they're at. So that was a big, that was a rude awakening for me, but a very important one, especially when I work with Arabs and Muslims, or I work with the Hindu or different people like that, to just respect their ways and not go in a direction to sometimes ask them to compromise their value system. You got to be very careful about that.
Chloe, tell us about a therapeutic failure that you learned from.
Okay. It was not a total failure, but it was a failure, important, serious failure, really, from my point of view. When I had my institute in Washington, I frequently got referrals from a local hospital, a psychiatric institute in a hospital that specialized in anorexia. And I would always take them because I wanted to help train the psychiatric residents and so on. I wanted to show them what you could do with family therapy. So sometimes I did the therapy for free. Often they would send me a family and with whom they had failed seriously. And they would say, you have to do the therapy, not one of the students. We're just referring to you. So they send this family, 12 or 13-year-old girl, very small for her age, very skin and bones, completely anorexic. She had been hospitalized with no results and so. And I was naive. I totally believed the family's lies. From the very beginning, they were lying like crazy. And I was just thinking, this little girl can die. They would not be lying to me. So first they lied about the family money. It turned out that they were hugely wealthy. And I was seeing them for free because they didn't want to pay. And they lied to me. They lied to me about what the father did, about what the grandfather did. Eventually, I found out because I found out the address of the parents and their address in Washington, D.C. So I just knew the value of that place. The mother was a nurse. I assumed that as a nurse, she was a kindly, compassionate person that was dedicated to helping people. She was not, but she totally, I was completely fooled. Every time that I said, there has to be something in the family, there's some issue in the family that is not being addressed, they would say, no, we all get along. We all get along so well. The only problem is this girl that won't eat. And we're all just getting along. I saw the grandmother came to a session. She was a very nice lady. She was very polite to her daughter-in-law and to her son, and to the very warm with the children. And I kept buying into this. Meanwhile, the little girl kept losing weight or barely staying stable. And so one day I just said to them, I can't go on like this. There's something that you're hiding from me. There's something awful happening here. And you have to tell me what it is. And I looked at the anorexic girl and I said, please tell me. And she said, all right, my grandmother and my mother hate each other. And they really hate each other. They cannot stand each other. And that's the terrible thing that's going on because I love my grandmother and I love them. And the other, she was the oldest, the other children also. And this is a horrible thing for us. So I totally changed their approach. I got the grandmother and the mother in the room, and I just said, you're killing this girl. It's your fault. You have to find what's good in each other. you have to get along, you have to show that you love each other sincerely, not fake, because if it's fake, it won't work. You have to appreciate each other. And I put it, you're killing this girl. It's your responsibility. You're killing her. And they did it. And the girl began to eat, and she was fine. But I consider it a failure because she already had bone loss. So she was a little humped over like this because of bone loss in this. That should not have happened. If 3 months sooner I had realized what was going on between that grandmother and the mother. So I'm not naive anymore. I just assume everybody's lying. I don't believe anything they say. Especially when they're saying that everything is fine, they don't understand whatever the person with a symptom has, they don't understand how it happened because everybody's happy and fine and gets it. I never believe that.
So it's interesting in, we've talked about theory, we've talked about technique in both in Norm and Frank's stories, they're tapping into the therapeutic relationship, which many people believe is a necessary but not sufficient ingredient in all good therapies, meaning you have to have a therapeutic alliance. Norm's story was of a split alliance when you're not attuned to it. Frank unintentionally had a tear in the alliance when he was not attuned to these cultural factors. I am curious what your all's thoughts are on how you develop a strong therapeutic alliance with a client system. And then not only how you create one, how you repair after a tear. Because I think if you do this work long enough, if you're working with more than one person in the room, it comes with the territory. So let's talk about how to build an alliance and then how to repair one after a tear.
In keeping with the spirit of what Chloe said about being a human being, when I had some early analytic training, it was a very clear rule. You never, ever apologize to a patient. I don't agree with that. Help me repair the rupture with this father from this former Soviet country was to be able to humble myself and tell him I erred and I made a mistake. And I apologized to him. That was so important to him because
I teach that all the time. I teach all my students that because so many of the students are afraid of making a mistake. And so I say, if you make a mistake, the important thing is to immediately say, I'm sorry. My fault. I made a mistake. I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have do for that. I totally, sincerely apologize. And that is so crucially important in therapy.
It is. I totally agree with that. And also, if you're doing a family, it models for people, like it's a good thing to admit when you made a mistake.
Exactly.
And I even learned how to say I effed up in Polish because
how do you say that, Frank?
I wouldn't say it anyway. They would probably have a bunch of Polish listeners.
We have a big Polish listenership. Yep.
The point is that from the very get-go of making lots of good empathic listening, showing that you truly want to know this person and find out what's important to them, what their concerns are. And if you make a mistake and there is a rupture, immediately showing that you care about that and that you feel bad about it, you like to reconnect with them and listen to what was upsetting to them, why, and what could be done about them.
And Carl Whitaker believed that when he cried with a family over a tragedy, he bonded with him in that way, that he showed the ultimate compassion that he was able to break down and express that emotion. So I think that's very important. Clients are not dumb. They'll know if you really are genuine or not. I've had a lot of people say to me, you really do care about us, don't you? And absolutely. It's important, your growth and everything else. It's not just a number. You're not just a number on a chart. And I never had a chart that ever had a number. That's important. The other thing I think is to talk with them a little bit and just sometimes in the beginning, just talk a little bit about general stuff and not just jump right into the therapeutic agenda, but just talk a little bit about what's going on in the world and so on and so forth. So they feel like, yeah, he's just a real person. I had a disastrous call one time from a guy. He called me up and he said, this is so-and-so. Do you remember me? And of course, as a good psychologist, I lied and I said, oh yeah, sure. I didn't remember what I ate for breakfast that day. How am I going to remember it? I saw him about 30 years ago. And he said, the reason I'm calling is I'm cleaning. I just retired and I cleaned out my desk and I found your card and I wondered if you're still here. And he said, I saw you back when I was in college. And of course, putting my angst aside that he's younger than I am and he's retiring and I'm still working. But I said, yeah, it's good to hear from you. And I got a little selfish. And I said, so you said I really helped you. What was this specific thing that I helped you turn the corner with? I was hoping that he would say some kind of technique or innovative move in therapeutic. He said, you were just you. Well, what the hell does that mean? What? He said, no, you were just a genuine person in your work with me. I don't remember what you did, but I was very depressed. I was suicidal. Yeah, help me work or play my way out of it, whatever you did. But I remember some great things, but I just remember that your personal style touched me and helped me make change. And then I thought about, damn, that Sal Maluchin was right. It was a reflective instrument of change in some ways, aside from the technique. But Harry Aponte talks about the person of the therapist, and he's absolutely right about that. That's everything with regard to what we do, because it doesn't get more personal than the work that we do.
Actually, in all the years of my training therapists at University of Maryland, one of the things that the young therapists, the students would worry about is, how do I come across as professional? Like most of my clients are older than me. Some of them could be my grandparents, and that they were so worried about learning the techniques and seeing me real professional and seeing coming serious and all that. And one of the things I tried to emphasize is that one of the strengths you do have is being a good person and listening to them and caring about them and your relationship that you have with them. And that's going to go a long way. And that if you just come in and try to be this sort of machine coming out reciting all these techniques, it's not going to connect with them the same way. So be yourself. That's going to matter a lot.
Yes, I'm listening to all of this is so great. And Frank's story made me think about what we call the pivotal moments question. When you ask a client or a system, because as therapists, we think we have this therapy-centric view that we know best, but what often is the most pivotal moment for a client in a session or a therapy is not what we think it is. And client really does know best. So Frank naturally in his style asked that at the end, and it was somewhat surprised by the client's answer. Feedback is essential, not only giving it to clients, but being able to receive it. I am curious, what is the most important or thought-provoking piece of feedback that you've ever gotten from a client in your career that has really made you think about how you do what you do?
Too difficult. Very difficult question.
You all are masters, so I'm asking the difficult questions because I do think once we stop being open to feedback or we think we have it all figured out, that's how you lose perspective and you miss things. And that's why asking for feedback is just as important as giving it to clients. So yeah, you could take a couple minutes to think about, but I am curious because those are the type of things that master therapists are really attuned to. They just don't play the pat hand. They evolve, they grow, they respond. They don't make the client match their worldview. Clients have enough problems. The therapist flexibly adapts to them by taking in that feedback. So I know I'll answer it first to get you all going. I know when I ask this question, I am always amazed that people remark on that, back to what Frank was saying too, and what your ex-husband would call the social stage of therapy, Chloe, this being able to join and be able to know things about them and remember. I don't know my right from my left, but I have a near photographic memory, and I've found in my life that making a connection and remembering something about a client system, each person, and being able to weave that in an organic way, not a way to show off that I have a good memory, really meant a lot, that I remembered a special date or that I remembered a family member's event. And so I get a lot of feedback on my memory. And that is something that's really organic to me because, as we've been saying, when you care about a client system, it is a real person relationship. Therapy, I'm often drawn to Martin Buber's work, philosopher, I, thou, versus the way we interact with someone versus therapy is something we do to someone versus a relationship and interaction. For me, it's feedback I get on my memory and my ability to remember important things about the clients I'm working with. So there, I bought you a couple extra minutes. So who's doing
it? I don't want to get this, make this an easy out, but I actually, that really resonates for me because that's one of the things my clients know that I take notes when I do, and I say, because I want to make sure I remember important stuff. So I do that, but I don't constantly stare at them and we're coming to a session and I will start talking and I'll bring up something that they mentioned a month ago. And they have actually commented on it. That meant a lot to them, that I actually spend time thinking about them. I remember things. So I think that's a really important.
I never take notes and I never forget anything about a family or a student. I just remember everything. You ask me about where's my bank account or how much money was in the bank. I have no clue. I don't remember anything like that. It's a miracle that I remember my own phone number, but I remember the people that I work with every detail, and they love that, of course.
About 20 years ago, I contracted a viral neuropathy known as Guillain-Barré, and I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. And when it became clear that it was quite progressive and serious, I had to start making some decisions on what to do. And my first concern, aside from my family, it was to call patients and let them know that I was going to be out and I didn't know how long it was going to be. And rather than have a secretary, I did it myself. I had my wife hold the phone up from the hospital and I would talk to them and tell them what was going on. And I was really very surprised with how compassionate they were that I get better and take the time that I need. And many of them said, I'll be okay because you taught me how to cope. And that made me realize that's good to know. I like to think that it helped me improve a lot faster to get back to doing the work that I do. So I knew that I was being successful with a lot of people because they felt that they would be okay. So that was some of the best feedback I ever got. They don't always tell you that. Sometimes they tell you by not coming back because they're feeling good enough that they don't need therapy anymore. But everybody has their own way of telling you. But that was very profound for me and changed me a lot.
I was thinking of another thing. I know in my early training as a therapist, I was talking a lot about boundaries and dual relationships, and you don't disclose a lot of personal stuff to your clients because they're kids and so forth. But I've become more comfortable as the years have gone on and just being myself and being comfortable with answering questions. They ask something about my life and so forth. I'm always aware of boundaries and I'm careful about it, but I'm more likely to be personal with them. And I've gotten feedback that they appreciate.
Yeah. Again, the relationship. And it's really interesting in what you all are saying, this feedback Frank's gotten and you've gotten, Norm. No one says, oh, I went to Frank because he would help me challenge my automatic negative thoughts. Although Frank probably did. And Norm's probably helped people cognitively restructure. Nobody's ever gone to you, Chloe, and said, oh, her strategic ways of working or paradoxical interventions really broke me out of my stuckness. No, people pick a therapist because of their humanity, their overall way of being and personal quality. I'm also asking everybody, what is something, again, that is not a technique or a piece of your theory, something about you that wasn't taught or trained in graduate school that makes you? I'll start. I'll give you one, Frank, because this is how you are in all the settings I've ever seen you in, whether it be a face-to-face interaction, in your writing, and certainly in your teaching and therapy. You're funny, Frank, and humor is a natural part of who someone is. And it's also, I think, very therapeutic. It's a question to each of you, these individual qualities you have. And I've studied you and know enough of you all that I could probably point out those personal qualities that I see in each of you, but I'm curious what you think first. So, Frank, how do you use humor to your advantage in your work?
I often use it. You have to be very careful. It can backfire. I usually use it on myself as opposed to other people. And like I'll poke fun at myself sometimes. Somebody came back to see me after many years and they said, my God, your hair turned white.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, it's not easy. I was walking past the cemetery the other day and two guys with shovels started running after me. I said, I don't even recognize myself anymore. But I think it's important. There's times to use it appropriately, and but your timing has to be right. If it's not right, then it doesn't go over well. And what I try to do is model for them to be able to sometimes, during times when they're most frustrated, to be able to use humor, to work or play yourself out of that depressive slump or that just a period of being blue, because you use more scientific tests show that tears of laughter have more endorphins in them than those that are up when people cry. And you feel better when you laugh or you can chuckle at yourself. I use that a lot in my work when I do seminars, and it gives people a break from some of the stodgy scientific stuff that you're covering. But I integrate it. I believe that's very important. And then just basically keeping it somewhat of an upbeat demeanor, except when obviously people are talking about tragic things.
Maybe, Norm, you could pick out something, unless you want me to reflect on what I pick up from you. You could pick up something of you that is a personal quality that makes you effective, that is not tied to a model or a technique.
Two things, dude, just to hear what you have to say. Anyway, I'm more low key in the general personal style than Frank is. I do use some humor too, and I think I actually catch people by surprise, which has a positive effect. So I will do a little gentle teasing, and I feel like it's safe to do that. So just about a week ago, I was talking to one of my clients, and who is a really anxious guy. And at one point I was talking about, I was catastrophizing with him about all this awful stuff that was going to happen. And he says, "You're teasing me, aren't you?" And we laugh together. That is definitely not a CBT technique. So I definitely do that. I also do share at times when it's relevant, some of my sort of observations about the world and life and some of the struggles and the coping with these things and acceptance of things, what you can do, what you can't do. And I definitely do some of that too.
And I think from getting to know you a little bit, I think you show your care, as you mentioned earlier, your diligence, your taking notes. You're a very accomplished academic, but you don't make people feel that way. And I think your groundedness and your calmness is very reassuring to people, even though you could act like a high and mighty scientist practitioner, but you don't. In fact, no one would know that about you that was your client unless you told them that. So I think you're humility and kind of care of the person and humbleness is one of those things that set you apart. What about you, Chloe?
Okay, I'll tell you a story. I think that for me, it is having, you say, leap of faith, doing something that I'm not quite sure that it may be right, it may be wrong, but I'm just going to put it out there because I feel that it, what is the truth, and it's not necessarily in any textbook. I don't think that I ever wrote this part about this case. Nobody in the family could understand why this girl was promiscuous. She was overweight. She didn't take care of herself, and she was out of control. She went to college, but didn't do any work and so on. So I invited the parents and the girl to his first session. Of course, the father didn't come. So the mother and the daughter came. And I said to the daughter, "I would like you to tell me the worst thing that ever happened to you in your entire life. The worst thing that somebody did to you or that you did to somebody. Just please tell me." And she said, "It wasn't abuse, it was love." And I said, "What was love?" High school teacher had molested her through 3 years of high school, and told her he didn't actually have sex with penetration, but he had promised her that they would actually have intercourse when she turned 17 or something like that. And then he left, went to work to another school. And these parents had been supporting the girl's school, completely funding this private school where their daughter was being abused like that. I called the father and I said, "You didn't come to the first session and you better come next time, because the consequences of you not participating are going to be very bad for you." So he came, and I immediately told him what had happened to his daughter, he had a very poor opinion of the girl, of course, because of her behavior. And so this explained all kinds of things about her behavior. And I immediately told him to get on the floor on his knees and apologize to his daughter for not having protected her from this school teacher and for not having been enough to the school, seeing who the teachers are, to be able to tell what was going on, and he didn't protect her. Then it turned out that her grandfather had also sexually molested her, and I had him apologize on his knees for that.
I will say that story exemplifies how I view you, that you have both these dialectical tensions. You have this softness that creates a safety for the people you work with, but you are a strong, a fearless person who models self-advocacy. So you have these both types of energy that both makes people feel safe and then helps them by your modeling to advocate for themselves.
Thank you for the flattery. I don't know why I think he's thinking, but the point of the story is what came next. I worked with a couple. It was a very bad relationship. They decided to divorce. They were in the process of divorcing. And all of a sudden, he shows up in my office with a young woman, and without an appointment or anything, he just shows up. And he says, I need you to speak to this young lady that is here with me, because as soon as the divorce is finalized, I want to marry her, but I want to know your opinion first. So I said, all right, you can wait in the waiting room and I will talk to her. So I talked to her maybe for 20 minutes, half an hour, something. And then I thanked her. So he came in and I said, she's after your money. She's going to make your life miserable. She doesn't care about you at all. You've got to get rid of her. Oh, dog, why do you say this? And I said, I'm certain this is going to happen. She's going to take you for your money. And she knows how to do it. To make a long story short, she got pregnant and said that it was his child, and very Catholic family. So the ex-wife said, I will raise that child as if it were mine, and we will support this young woman with everything. He already had given her so much money and all that. He talked with me again, and I said, you have to have a paternity test. It wasn't his child. And she had taken him for so much money. So from then on, he really believed that I was a witch. Because I don't know how I could predict it by talking to this young woman. But I could just see the way she was. So sometimes I just take a risk and make a recommendation or jump to a conclusion that I'm not sure how I could justify. And I know Virginia Satir was like that, because very often people would say to Virginia, how did you know that would happen? And Virginia would say, intuition. I don't think it's intuition. I think it's that I can see the clues. I can see some clues that perhaps other people cannot see. I don't think it's even intelligence, but it's a sensitivity to what people are hiding, something like.
Well, a good example of the use of humor in therapy is, if you ever saw the movie Good Will Hunting, which is a short movie, and Matt Damon plays Good Will Hunting, and Robin Williams plays a therapist, and throughout the movie, he uses humor in his work with Damien. As the patient, which is tumultuous early on, and it really makes some great headway. And at the very last session, he said, that's it, we're finished, you've completed your therapy. And he said, that's it, I can go. And he said, yeah. So he gets up, and you can see it's hard for him, but he hugs Robin Williams as his therapist, and he said, thanks so much. And he hugs him for a long time. And Matt Damon says, does this violate the therapist-client relationship? And Robin Williams says, only if you grab my ass. And it's a good line, because humor, but not inappropriately. And Matt cracks up and he says, I'm going to miss your humor. And that's very important. It sometimes helps us make the kind of headway we need to make.
Everybody in our esteemed panel today is still finding a way to do this work, because not because they need to for a paycheck, it's because they want to. Chloe has taken hers on to coaching and teaching. Norm is retired from academia, but is still clinically active. Frank is still teaching, training, seeing clients. Again, it is amazing that this is a profession that, as long as you stay curious, as long as you are self-reflective, as we have been talking about today, you can't really age out of. But the people that have been doing it this long at this level, there is a secret to their success. So that is the last question. Why are you still doing what you're doing, and what keeps you vital so long after you begin your career as a helping profession?
Okay. I feel so fortunate to have been in this field all these years, because it's fascinating to me, and there's still, it's developing all the time. And I like reading the latest things that people are writing about it, new ideas. And I still do some teaching. I'm an emeritus professor at University of Maryland, but I did a guest lecture in a class a couple of weeks ago. I've gone and done some supervision. So it's because it's fun. It's intellectually stimulating. I like it. And it's nice to know that when I'm doing the clinical work, I'm still helping people. Just published a couple of therapy treatment planner book.
Really retired, Norm.
People have said, you're what, retired? No, I still would say I'm doing much less work than I used to at the university. No committees, none of that stuff. But it's, I can pick and choose when I'm doing things. I do things that are fun.
It's great.
I do what I do because it's so difficult. I still find it so difficult. It's very difficult to do therapy. It's even more difficult to teach therapy or to teach coaching, life coaching, whatever we're doing. We're just trying to help people have better lives and get along better. And it's very difficult to help them. And I like the challenge. There's not a moment of boredom. Every time that I teach a class, I'm exhausted afterwards, because my brain is going. I find it very difficult. It also has moments of fun, but mostly it's the difficulty that I see it as an intellectual and emotional challenge. And yeah, that's what I like about it.
I love it. Frank, you're going to get the last word.
I think the easiest answer is just because I love what I do. And I do a lot less of it because I'm getting up there, and 46 years is plenty of time in a saddle. So I can be a little bit more selective and work with different kind of cases that aren't as challenging as they used to be sometimes. But it's, I owe society to give something back. And with so many years of experience, if I can still help them, that helps me help them and feel good about what I do. And never stop getting a kick out of some of the people I work with. I was working with a guy the other day, and he had a lot of unrelenting ringing in his ear. And I asked him the other day, do you still have that ringing in your ear? He said, no, that went away. I said, well, that's good. He said, but now I'm getting the dial tone. And I looked at him and he said, I'm just kidding. So I realized I had some kind of influence on everything. He's grown a sense of humor that he didn't have before. So I don't want to stop that. I'll do it on my own terms. And I like mentoring young people who are just getting started because they have no clue where to go and which way to go. And let me show you the path and talk with them. And that's always good to see them grow and develop.
I have enjoyed this immensely. I knew this would be an eclectic, but the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, as we say in systems. So this was a great dialogue, and I can't thank the three of you enough. And this is going to be an amazing contribution to this all-star panel. Thank you, Frank DiTilio, Norm Epstein, and Chloe Madonis. What a great conversation you've had. Eli, bringing to a close another unforgettable conversation in the All-Star Panel Series of the AAMFT podcast. Listening to Chloe Madonis and Frank DiTilio together is like hearing two living chapters of our field's history, full of creativity, intellect, and deep reverence for the healing power of relationships. Their stories remind us that systemic therapy has always been both an art and a science,
and an ever-evolving dialogue between structure and spontaneity, between precision and heart. As we close this episode, we also pause to honor the memory of Dr. Norm Epstein, who passed away shortly after we filmed this episode on October 17, 2025. Norm's voice was meant to be part of this panel, and his absence today is deeply felt. For decades, Norm's work shaped how we understand cognitive behavioral couple therapy, communication, and emotional regulation in intimate relationships. But beyond his remarkable scholarship, Norm was known for his warmth, his generosity, and his mentorship, quietly influencing thousands of therapists who carry his teachings forward in their own work every day. And you can see that in our conversation today. Quietly regulating things between the bombastic personalities of Frank and Chloe, Norm's legacy reminds us that great therapy and great teaching is about helping others to see the best in themselves and in the people they love. His wisdom and humanity will continue to live on in the countless lives of those he touched, his family, his students, his clients. Chloe, Frank, and Norm each represent the best of what it means to be a systemic thinker, curious, compassionate, and relentlessly hopeful about what's possible in human relationships. Rest in peace, Norm Epstein. If you enjoyed these all-star panel conversations, be sure to check out other episodes in this special series featuring the trailblazers and the innovators who've defined our field and those carrying it forward. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, pass it along to a friend or colleague. Remember, there's now 7 full seasons of in-depth interviews, thought-provoking discussions with the biggest names in our field, all available in our podcast archive. Make sure to follow the AAMFT on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, X for the latest updates in our profession. Please subscribe to the show, leave a review, let us know what you want to hear next. To connect with me directly, visit elikaram.com. That's ELIKARAM.com for free resources, speaking info, and more. If you're looking to grow your clinical skills or pass that pesky MFT exam, check out my 2 latest books, Marriage and Family Therapy, Official National Exam Study Guide. It's a comprehensive evidence-informed guide designed to help you conquer the AMFT-RB license exam with confidence. It's got practice questions, exam strategies, and insights from yours truly. Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy with AAMFT President and my co-author Adrian Blow is written to ignite your energy and creativity. It offers a practical roadmap for using the common factors to enhance your effectiveness, reduce burnout, and revitalize your systemic work, whether you're a seasoned clinician or you're just starting out. Until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay curious, and most importantly, stay systemic.